Thanks for tuning in to the World XP Podcast. If you're enjoying the content, please drop a sub, drop a like, and let us know your thoughts below in the comments. Also, please consider supporting our podcast via the link below. It really helps us out.
Rick, welcome to the World XP Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well, Eric. Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate your invitation. Thank you very
much. I appreciate your time. So for those listening who don't know anything about you, let's do a quick intro, like who you are and what do you do. And then we'll, as always, jump into the question from the last guest, and then we'll just jump right into it.
Okay, excellent. Well, I am Rick Cicetti. Given name was Richard. And I grew up in New Jersey. Somebody had to, and I felt I was strong enough to do that. So that's where my story began. And what I do today is really consulting, life coaching, and I'm also a certified hypnotherapist, which I do incorporate into both the consulting and life coaching. But my path has taken many turns through the years, and so some find that rather interesting. Others say, golly, couldn't you keep a job? But the good news is really I've created every opportunity that I've had. And they were always by choice, sometimes not part of a long-term plan, but inspired by the moment and opportunities. So this current edition of Rick Cicetti is really the sum total of all the things that I've done before. So the ability to be able to help people who are on their way or entering fields that I have been in or exited already, and help them get a leg up, help them get some perspective, some insight, and help them with answers to the questions that they have.
Sounds good. I'm excited to explore that for sure. The question from the last guest is, what methods or activities do you do to take your mind off your, I will say, work or business ventures that allows you to recharge or end or come back motivated? So do you have an off switch for your business work mind? Because I know you've done a lot of different things, and a lot of people can kind of fill that time with just other work.
Well, that tends to be the tendency in our culture. And that's unfortunate, I think, because I'm reminded of the quote by Deepak Chopra, who says, keep in mind, we are human beings. We are not human doings. In our culture, the tendency is to just keep do, keep doing more. And that's not who we are. That's not how we're designed. And so I think that is a testament to so much of the frustration that goes on in our culture these days. What do I do to hit the off switch, if you will? Or maybe it's the on switch, because it is the place that I get my energy. It's the place that I get my perspective from. And that's really being in nature. It's important. I'm fortunate enough. I live in Southern California, and I'm not far from the beach, and that ocean air and being able to absorb the beach life, if you will, the beach lifestyle. I enjoy sailing. I enjoy golf. I love being able to sit around in outdoor cafes with friends and conversing. And those are the things that really fuel or charge my batteries, if you will, because it stimulates thought outside of what my current parameters are.
Do you make, just to follow up on that, do you make a point to do that every day, or do you have a, is it kind of a feel type thing? You have a half an hour to go for a walk or something, or do you make a point to do it?
Well, I don't schedule it. And I say that somewhat reluctantly, because I think people should, and I know that it's one of my shoulds, if you will. But I always make it a point to do it. And sometimes it's as simple as being out in the garden, which my father, rest his soul wherever he is chuckling right now, because as an adolescent, it was one of the things that he tried to get me to do, were chores around the house, doing the garden, working, reading, mowing the lawn. And I abhorred that stuff. I would much rather have been off playing ball with my friends. So to find that I get great solace in having my hands in the soil and nurturing seeds to seedlings, to plants, to ultimately being able to select some of that fruit and vegetables and herbs that I have in my garden, I find it's a very enriching and perhaps a meditative or Zen-like practice. I think it's important to be out in nature.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, so I want to start with for those who've been listening for a while, no, I like to kind of explore the path to get for people to get where they were. So for you, what was the high school like kind of up to that point, and then it converted ways? Or a lot of people that listen to this, I think, have the okay, I'll go to high school, go to college, get a job. And then maybe have a family, hopefully, and then die. So
That
where
came after the hopeful part, I think.
it definitely did. So where were you on the like maybe like teenage type years? What was family like? Did you have support to go pursue? You didn't mention this, but for those listening, Rick was also in was is also an actor. Did you have the support to kind of pursue those types of things, or what was the family environment like to push you in whatever direction, or like where did you kind of in your brain the I need to do all these things to be fulfilled, like where were you at when you were when you were that age? Did you have the go be a doctor or whatever from your parents, or kind of what was that situation for you like?
I think I was very fortunate. Certainly I can say that easily looking back, because I grew up in a very tight-knit family. We were an Italian-American family. My father was first generation Italian-American, and I had a lot of uncles, aunts, and cousins. Certainly we had a large circle, and it was part of our social life. So I had a great deal of support, and I felt loved. I think that's important because these days, a lot of times people are confused as to what that is. But I was blessed. I had their support. And my dad was what we call today a workaholic, although that was certainly not the way he felt about it, nor us as a family. Because he had limited education, he worked hard. He loved my mother very much. He loved us kids very much. And his way of showing that was working long days, 6 days a week, and in doing so he could provide us with a quality of life, live in a good neighborhood, get an education that he never had. It was his commitment to us. He just barely finished high school. And his dedication and hard work was a two-edged sword, if you will, because to me, as a youngster, we're talking about those adolescent ages, I was very, how would I say, put off by the fact that I didn't have somebody to throw the ball around with. I didn't have the dad that was a coach, so to speak. But I was always well aware of the fact that the reason I didn't have it wasn't because he was out with friends. It wasn't because he was out playing golf or doing things. He was working, and he worked, and the first thing he would do when he came home was look for my mom. And I can remember as a young boy, running up to him in the driveway and saying, "Hey, Dad, Dad," because I wanted to tell him about my day. And he said, "Just a moment, son, where's your mother?" He'd go and find her. They would lock in an embrace that would make people blush. And once he had that, he would turn around and say, "Now, son, tell me about your day." So I think it was important to mention the fact that I saw what love was. I learned from the evidence in front of me as to what that was. And so I never really questioned it. It was very evident to me, and our family was very secure in that. Mom took care of the kids. Dad took care of, our lifestyle and everything about it. And we just all understood that. Now I have three siblings. I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger sister. Now, the older two were 9 and 10 years older than myself. So it was really like having two sets of parents. And I think the younger set were more strict than the older set. The older set came by life by understanding and experience. And my brother and sister came by it by doing what they thought should be the case, So I would get instructions, if you will, from them. But there was never a template like, to be a doctor, to be a lawyer. My mother's probably mantra till the day she passed, just a couple years ago, was, "I just want you to be happy. I want you to do what makes you happy." And I heard that enough times that it sunk in. And it was part of the conflict, of course, because my father's ethic was work and discipline, and that didn't seem like what made me happy. So we were constantly at odds. And one of the realizations I came upon as I became an adult and matured a bit was that Dad and I locked horns often, but it was because we loved each other. And that's a message to, I think, a lot of people too, who may be hearing this, is if we didn't love each other, we would have walked away. We would have not conflicted. We wouldn't have had those challenges. But it was because we cared so much about each other. He was making it a point for me to understand how important and integral discipline was. And I was trying to convince him how much a love of life and joy was important. And so we would lock horns pretty regularly, and the other three siblings would always kind of sit back a little bit because they followed the rules. They were the ones that did what they were told. And I love them dearly. We're still all four of us very close. But I was the different one. I was the one that had to test everything. And in doing so, my circle of friends became a very important part of my life. They were extended family. And I think that's true for a lot of people, particularly in their adolescence. But I was also a bit lost. And I say that because I was fairly popular. I had a good circle of friends. Yet I always felt I had this unanswered question about, do people really understand me? Do people really know me? And that always lingered in the back of my mind. And it really started on, because I think part of your question goes to where did the roots there begin to plant to become who I grew to later. And my mother had the wisdom. She too had only a high school education, but she had a lot of wisdom as well. And she got me a book.
Was there a lot of, like, you better get good grades in your house as well?
No, it was expected, but it was never like you better.
Okay.
There was, why aren't you doing more in school? I can remember notes from grammar school on my report card that said, if Richard would pay as much attention into the front of the room as he does staring out the window, he'd be a very good student. And of course, at the time, that troubled me because that's where my interests were. I was easily misled. School wasn't challenging enough for me. And so I kind of discarded it in a lot of ways. Looking back, I think that was a great gift because staring out the window, if you will, or daydreaming, as some would call it, led me to a lot of discovery, a lot of wonder, a lot of creativity. And my mother had given me a book during my adolescence by Deepak Chopra, not, sorry, not Deepak Chopra, Dr. Wayne Dyer. And it was called Pulling Your Own Strings. And another one followed was called Your Erroneous Zones. And these fascinated me because all of a sudden I started to understand myself. I started to understand the patterns. We're not taught that too much in life. We're certainly not taught that in school, but pattern recognition is probably one of the most important things an individual can learn. Being able to see the patterns, being able to see those that are positive, those that may be detrimental, and learning how to ultimately interrupt those patterns. So that kind of embarked me on the journey of discovering who I was. I was able to question it through some of the information in these books, and I kept pursuing it. And in high school, there was a small circle of my friends. We became part of a leadership group that was offered by the YMCA. And we liked it because it was this special club. And this special club was a place where we could gather and have fun. But we also talked about serious topics. And I had a coach in high school. And I'll mention his name. God bless him. He's still alive. And I still get to visit with him periodically, Mr. Berry. And he would have us gather at his house on Monday nights. And there was about 12 of us, and we would have these conversations that were called agree disagree sheets. So they were challenging topics to get young men to start thinking.
What kind of topics?
Oh, they ventured from everything from family life to sociological life, moral questions. You know, how would you deal with this? How would you deal with that? If you feel this is right and wrong, then how do you explain that? And
What
it stimulated thought.
time frame is this about?
That was, I would say, 15, 16, 17 years old.
So like what's going on in the world? Like are you I'll say required loosely, but are you having to pay attention to what's going on in the world or the country to participate in this, or is this kind of expected that you have a view of not just your town or your YMCA club or whatever, but what's going on outside and how it relates to, right? If you're confronted with blank situation, you would do blank, right? Are you required to kind of start to put those pieces together and figure out how you fit in the world already by this time? Or are you how extensive is that?
Well, let me put it in a time frame that'll help people understand. I think it was the 60s. So I graduated high school in 66. So at that period of time, there was what we're discovering today might have been the great myth, you know, of all the ideals and the virtues. We didn't understand what was going on behind the scenes. We had no knowledge of, you know, of what people refer to today as puppet masters you know, hidden agendas. We didn't understand that. So, you know, our culture in the community that I lived in was basically Irish, Jewish, and Italian. And we all got along really well. We didn't understand conflicts. We didn't understand prejudices. And then around 1967 is when those things started to bubble up. The social unrest and prejudices, particularly towards the Black community, you know, and there was the civil rights movement. So that was where we started to sink our teeth in. So it was really kind of after those social groups that we had that what was laid out as a foundation then stimulated us to be able to think and reason with what was coming, the unrest. The YMCA afforded us the exchange of competing with other neighborhoods and things. So, you know, I had a lot of friends and a lot of different ethnicities, and never had an issue. I mean, I think my earliest friend from as far back as preschool was a fellow who lived in the neighborhood when we lived in Newark, New Jersey, which was the inner city. And he was a Black fella. His father was a professor at Seton Hall University. And Kenny and I were just like thick and thin. We were always together. And so, you know, when this stuff all came up later, it was abstract to me because I didn't live that. I didn't live the conflict. I didn't know that. And those divisions started to really challenge the beliefs and the cultural norms that we thought there were. You know, there was always that cute little phrase, well, some of my best friends are Black. Well, you know, that doesn't wash really if it's trying to get you accepted. But if in fact you understood that and you lived that, then all this was very confusing. You know, why the disruption? Why the civil rights movement? But then, of course, education came along with it and you understood it wasn't like that everywhere. It certainly wasn't like that for everybody. And that said, that's where the awakening really began, because I was understanding myself through understanding psychology. I was embracing psychology, and you know, it wasn't a term then, but really human behavior, understanding and grasping human behavior, and knowing that I wanted to do what I felt was my soul work, you know, what I needed, my passions, and that became its own challenge. Because I kept looking, you know, I'd see people who had a burning passion to be a doctor, to be an attorney, to do whatever. And I thought, golly, I don't know what I'm passionate about. And I kept looking at passion as something that I might find in the next person that I met, the next friendship, the next female relationship, the next job, the next class, the next school. And I made a startling discovery many years later that cleared that up for me. You decide what you're passionate about.
Yeah.
It's a choice. And it's not something, I thought that it was something that was supposed to pop up in front of me and go, oh, you know, here I am. This is your passion. And that wasn't the case. And I don't want to skip too far ahead. So you tell me if you have some
intermittent
questions.
So you graduate high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then is college the next step?
It was. Not because it was necessarily what I wanted. I wasn't grasping for it, but it was the norm.
Right.
You know, you kind of marched in step.
When did that become the norm? And like now, today, like if the college is almost like second high school, almost.
Yeah.
When did that, like, was it, well, you say it's the norm. So was it the norm everywhere? Was it getting to there? Or was it fairly new at that point? I don't remember my history exactly for that.
It was the norm everywhere that I saw. So wherever I looked, people graduated from high school. And if you kept the grades up and you had your SAT scores, you got into college. And if you didn't, there was a negative connotation to that. You know, today we're learning how valuable the trades are and that working in the trades is a very important thing. And it has a great deal of respect to it. See, that's all turned around. Back then, if you got out of high school, it was almost expected. Well, what schools are you looking at, you know, for university, for college? And so you kind of adopted that, or at least I did at the time. And sure, you know, okay, one foot in front of the other, I'm going to go to college. And I didn't have all the grades that I should have had.
So where were you looking? I guess what I'm getting at is at what point did you decide, or where the mindset of, okay, I want to leave New Jersey and go to Southern Cal. Was there a move in between, or like where was the thought process of like, I need to get out of here and find something new, or was it, I want to go specifically there, or like, when did that happen? And if there's stuff that's in between, well, let's definitely cover that a little bit as well.
Yeah, there's quite a bit to that, Eric. And I mean, part of why I say that is because I never left where I was at any point in my life because I didn't want to be there.
Hmm.
I left because I saw something somewhere else that I wanted. I saw something that I wanted to get a hold of. And so there were many steps between growing up in middle New Jersey and ending up here in Southern California. I went away. I was off at CW Post College, part of Long Island University. I played lacrosse, and that was a great honor to me. Lacrosse was very new at that point in time to many schools. It was very popular and had a great history in the Syracuse, New York area, in the Long Island area, and in the Annapolis, Maryland area.
My dad grew up in upstate, so
other than that, it was something people didn't even know of. And we had a football coach who introduced it in our high school that last summer. And I took to it, and I wound up going up to CW Post. And college experience for me at that point in time was an education, but not the one that was intended. CW Post was a very social school, and it was in a very upper echelon area of Long Island, Glen Cove, Brookville, Long Island. In fact, the name itself, CW Post, was the Clarence Post Estate. And he was the one who created Postum, which later became General Foods, so on and so forth. And his wife was Marjorie Merriweather Post, who created Mar-a-Lago. So we hear of that today. We don't know the history of it so much, but that was their winter home. So this university was a campus on an elegant estate. And I'm away from home. There were plenty of good-looking girls. And what I learned mostly were the social skills that benefited me later in life, not the educational ones. So I struggled with classes. I was doing well with sports. I was doing well socially. And the dean of men at the end of the year had to have a conversation with me and said, Rick, you knew the rules. And you weren't to fail any classes, and you failed Western Civ. You weren't to play any varsity sports, and I understand you played varsity lacrosse. You weren't to be in a fraternity your freshman year, and I understand you were in the Jock House fraternity. He says, so we're going to suggest.
Oh, for three.
Yeah, well, that was it. And the fourth one actually was, and you needed to maintain a 2.0 average. And so my argument was, I had a 2.6. I said, so in spite of all those distractions, look at how well I did. He said, good try. He said, but we think you should go somewhere else for a semester and then come back. Well, the caveat to that was, at that point in time, we were faced with Vietnam. And if you weren't in a college or a university, if you didn't have a teaching credential, you were on the list to go. And at that point in time, we had what was called the draft lottery. My number was 71. And I remember that night we're sitting around with a bunch of chums and we're watching the lottery take place on a TV and waiting for our numbers to come up.
That's how
And
it happened. They didn't like
that's
send
how it
it. It
happened.
was on TV. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it was on TV. And they called off the lottery, and my birthday came up as number 71. Now, these were random. They were picked, with ping pong balls out of a tumbler. And if you were under 200, you were probably going to Vietnam. So I was faced with the draft physical, and I went down there. And at that point, I was pretty adamant. I don't know where the wisdom came from at that point in time, but I had no fight with these people. I didn't think they had any fight with me, and I didn't see the value in going to Vietnam. I will tell you, and I must say, I have the greatest respect for the veterans that went, for those who came back and were unappreciated. At the time, I just didn't see it as my fight. And so I fought that. And I went to the American Friends Association, which was the, I'm forgetting the term right now. Nixon was a Quaker. It was the Quaker organization to learn how to become a conscientious objector. And that didn't pan out so well, but I went down for my physical. And because of my character and the way I presented myself at the time, I was given a very unique category. There was 1A meant you're going, 4F meant you can't go. You were physically enabled or for some other reason. And I got what was called a 1Y, which meant they would only call me in the case of a national emergency. Well, the Vietnam War was not a war. It was a skirmish. It was a conflict. It was not really ever dedicated or identified as a war. We use that term, but it's incorrect. It was the Vietnam conflict. Had it become a war, I would have been called up. Well, that gave me the opportunity to start working with other people and trying to help them. It helped me really define my moral character and knowing that, I had to have a reason for things. What was my purpose? What was my passion? And it helped me dig so much deeper into that. And I wound up going off to school at Kansas State Teachers College in Emporia, Kansas. And I spent 3 semesters there, which, as undesirable as Kansas seemed at the time, it was much nicer than Saigon. It was a far better option to me at that point in time. And there too, I learned how to have an enjoyable time, but I also got very intense into the arts. And I was a creative person. I was gifted with the ability to draw and to paint some, but I was fascinated with the arts and the Renaissance period. So I studied that and then decided that photography was really my vocation. That was what I wanted. So I found this school, which at the time was one of the two greatest schools for photography in the world, called Brooks Institute in Santa Barbara, California. Well, I presented this idea to my father. Now, my father, a hardworking Italian who worked, 12 to 15 hours a day, 6 days a week,
What did he do?
he was a florist. He was an artisan as a florist, not just a merchant. And he had greenhouses. He was very gifted in that way, and he had a great way with people, but he hadn't been on an airplane since World War II.
Did he
And
serve?
yes, he did. He was in the army at that point in time. And so for me to come up with a school in California, living in New Jersey, and him busting his butt for every dollar we had as a family, this became a real flyer of an idea. And I said, Pop, I'm willing to work for it. I'm willing to do my part. I'll take out a student loan. I'll do whatever I can. This is what I want to do. He says, well, let's see if you have any talent. And he had a friend who worked with photography in New York with one of the big studios in New York City at the time. And he said, let's have him take a look at your work and see what he thinks. Well, this fellow, his name was Leo Dworkin. I remember him very clearly. He was quite a talented photographer and businessman. And he said to my father, he says, your son's got a lot of talent. He said, he does need the education. And he goes, that is a fine school to do it in. So my father set out and said, all right, I'll give you 6 months. If you don't prove yourself out there in the first 6 months, then I'm leaving you there. I'm thinking, well, that's not a bad idea. Santa Barbara, California versus Newark, New Jersey, Livingston, New Jersey. So I was set to do it. And I got out there and I got immersed in it. I mean, I truly just immersed myself in it. And I worked hard. I didn't waste the opportunity at all. And you know, that's how I finally got my degree. So I had a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Brooks Institute in Santa Barbara, California. And then from there, my goal was really to go out and taste life.
Can I?
Yes,
did you please. Feel any, I don't, maybe pressure is not the exact right word I'm looking for, but did you feel any sort of like, all right, this is the third school. If I don't do it now, like, this is not going to be a good look for me. Like, did you have any of that, or were you still kind of a free spirit in the mindset of, I need to explore and figure out what I want to do with my life? Or was it a little of both?
I think the second one, really. I think it was much more of that, I'm a free spirit, and this is what I want to do, and this is the path I've got to take to do it. And honestly, Eric, I marveled at people who could go away to a school after their senior year in high school and stay for 4 years. It's like, how do you do that? You know, that seemed odd to me. And I knew what I was doing was odd to all of them. There was an expression around the house that not only my father used, but my mother would use. And I think even my sisters and brother used. And it was always, oh, Richard, you know, here we go again. And so that was really the nature of things. And so, yeah, I was following that free spirit. I was that person. And that kept coming up time and time again. And I'm grateful to God for it. I am a man of faith. And I think that there's a way the good Lord always kind of showed me where the next path was. And it wasn't always clear in the beginning. But, you know, like climbing a mountain, the higher your elevation goes, the further you get along in the journey, the greater your vista. You're able to see more. You get able to get a better idea of where you're going. And that was it for me. And when I got out of film school, my desire was to travel around the country, which disappointed my parents because they thought, okay, he's out of university. Let's get him. You know, he's going to get a job and, you know, we're going to be proud of him. And I said, no, I want to go see the country. I want to see the world. And I'm only sorry I didn't take that opportunity to go off on a motorcycle through Europe. But I got a four-wheel drive Toyota Land Cruiser FJ40 model as my graduation present. And I had to pay for half of it, but that's the way my dad was. It was always about discipline and building character, to which I always contested and say, Dad, I am a character. Everybody tells me that. But I bought this Toyota Land Cruiser, and that's it. I packed it up with everything I owned and traveled around the country. I went through the Navajo Reservation. I went through Texas up into Chicago. I had friends that were in different universities around the country, so I'd go and visit them. And ultimately, we wound up at a wedding of one of our high school friends in White River Junction, Vermont. And we all circled together, and here's a whole collection of us that, you know, had gone different ways, and now we're brought back together. And they said, a couple of the guys said, we have a house on Cape Cod for the summer. You should come and join us. And I'm thinking, wow, that sounds good. I said, but, you know, I need to get to work. So I went home, and I had to sell that idea to my father. Now, you know, here he is. He didn't take any proper route up till now. We're hoping now that he's out of college, he's going to go to work. And here I'm telling them that I'm going to be on Cape Cod working in the resort business for the summer. And so I went up with the intention of staying for a week or two. And if I found a job, great. And if not, I had to go back and get to work. And I had some offers in New York in the world of photography, some very respectable ones. I was a hard-headed kid. I really was hard-headed and stubborn. And so I balked at a couple of these opportunities. And Irving Penn, who was a terrific photographer at the time, offered me a job. But because of the nature of that business, I would have been a lackey making minimum amount of money to just be an assistant. And I felt so cocky about it. I was a photographer in my own right. I didn't need that. Maybe one of the dumbest things I ever decided, because the future would have opened up tremendously if I had been an assistant to Irving Penn and then went out on my own. Didn't wasn't to be the case. And so I went off to Cape Cod, and I wound up in the bar and restaurant business to support myself. And through there, I met a lot of great people. There was a little boathouse club called Baxter's Boathouse Club in Hyannis. And all the who's who of the New England area would go through there. And I got to meet people like Ted Kennedy and, you know, Sergeant Shriver, and some of the Kennedy kids at that point in time. And I was having a great time. It was very idyllic. I was sailing regularly. I was, you know, competing in sailboat races. I was fishing, beach life, probably too many cocktails and too many girls. But that was the nature of the time. And then I just decided one day, I said, you know what? I said, last summer was great. It was just like this summer. And I have every reason to believe next summer would probably be just like this one too. I said, I need to go sink my teeth into something. And I had a friend on Cape Cod who had come out to California the year before.
Was there a moment when you was it one moment or a collection of moments or something that went off in your head that made you think that, or had you been thinking it for some time at this point? Like, is the free spirit kind of maybe not losing a little bit, but are you okay now? I've done all these things, and now I should probably figure out how I'm gonna, you know, like longevity.
Well, and honestly, Eric, I didn't think about it from a standpoint of longevity. I just knew I needed to make a change, because now I was in a pattern that wasn't changing.
Okay.
And this is an interesting little tidbit, or maybe not a tidbit, but my maternal grandmother was very into astrology. And as you can imagine, going through the 60s, everybody was all about, well, hey, what's your sign? What's your sign? Well, I knew that wasn't astrology, because my grandmother was very intense. She had studied it at Columbia University in New York, and she knew the very intricacies of it. And she passed away before she was ever able to do a chart for me. But because I had that reference, I sought out having my chart done, my astrological chart. I wanted to get some meaning to what was going on and why I was having these thoughts of it's time to move on, it's time to wander off. And I looked up a fellow, excuse me, on Cape Cod, who was, he managed a health food store that I used to go to all the time. And I said, Herb, who do we know that might be great in astrology? I need to get an in-depth kind of report. And he says, well, there's a fellow named Robert Hand, who lives out in Wellfleet on the Cape, which is towards the very end of the Cape Cod. And he writes the reference books that people use. We can contact him. So we did. And he said, well, I don't do charts anymore, but my assistants do. And so he set me up with a fellow, and this fellow, Steve Blake, invited me out to do the chart. He says, but I don't write anything down. He goes, I'll do your chart and I'll interpret it for you, but you bring along a cassette tape. Cassette tapes are something we used back in the time to take notes. And he says, bring along a cassette tape and you can record everything that I say. Well, I did. And when I stopped at what was a Cumberland Farms, like our 7-Elevens out here, to pick up a cassette tape on the way, all they had were four packs of 90-minute tapes. I said, all right, well, I'll use them up. I'll make sounds for phone number. Excuse me, that's something that was supposed to have been off. So I brought these four tapes in. I figured, well, we'll use one of them and that'll be fine. We went through three of them.
Oh,
He was
wow.
so fascinated with my chart. And he said to me, I wouldn't give anything up because I've always been very suspicious. And I said, okay, you tell me who I am. I'm not going to give you any clues because if this is really good and you're good at what you're doing, you'll be able to give me information. And he looked at me and he says, have you ever been an actor? And I said, why do you say that? And he says, well, because if an actor could create their own chart, this is the chart they would create. He says, it's uncanny. And I'm thinking, well, I said, that's something I've always wanted to do. But I thought everybody wanted to do that. This is not true because many people would be afraid to do it. Many people never gave it a thought one way or the other. And I said, well, geez, I was that kid that was like, Tom Cruise in Risky Business, with the microphone in the boxer shorts. When nobody was home, I'd take up a vase and I'd turn it upside down and I would start doing Frank Sinatra. But I thought every kid did that. I thought everybody wanted to do that. I thought that was a part of everybody's life. Well, certainly it was not. And I said, I have a friend who's out there in California and he's been asking me to come out. He was running a bar on Sunset Boulevard, and he said, we're making money hand over fist, but we have no idea what we're doing. He goes, you understand this business. Could you come out and help us out? And I said, well, I could do that because we have the summer or winter's off with the yacht club. So I arranged to come out. Oddly enough, a girl that I had lived with in Santa Barbara when I was in film school there had called. She didn't know Marcus. There was no reason for these two contacts to come about. And she says, Rick, we had a such a good relationship. I don't know whatever happened to us. Do you ever think about coming to Southern California again? And I'm thinking, oh, this is odd. And then an old roommate from film school calls me up and he says, Rick, he goes, I'm just going through a divorce. And he goes, we were pretty good roommates back in the day. He goes, if you ever come out to Southern California, he goes, I could use a roommate right now. I'm thinking, three separate individuals from Southern California are going like this. And here's my chart kind of confirming it. I said, we close up the yacht club. I'm headed out there.
So
So
you're
I went out.
about what, 20, late 20s at this point? Mid 20s?
I was 29. I was 29 at the point. So yeah,
Were
good time.
you when you were in art school or film school, did the acting route ever cross your mind to try and do that, or was it all photography to that point?
It was all photography. I think I always had that temptation, that desire, but I never gave it breath.
Hmm.
It was something that in my mind, and these are, we live by the stories we create. And in my mind, this was something for those kids who could afford to go into New York and take acting classes as a little kid. And I'm 29 years old. I'm thinking that train's left the station. And then it was pointed out to me one after another. Well, Sidney Greenstreet, the actor from Casablanca, he didn't start till he was 59 years old, and people kept citing individuals in cases like that. And I said, that gives me some inspiration, and I can do this. And I felt with the momentum of having the chart indicate that and people pulling me back to Southern California, I said, I'm going to go give it a shot. And if nothing happens so throughout the winter, I can always come back in the summer.
So you were
Or come back.
basically in your head, you're playing with house money. You're like, if I try it and it works, great. And if not, I'll just go back and it's fine.
I have that backup, yeah, plan.
That's
When I got out
that's
there.
gotta feel good to have kind of a safety net and a little bit of the pressure taken off you. You've got no like, oh, if it doesn't work, it's okay. So there's no, oh, I have to make this work for the paycheck or I'm gonna be homeless type deal. That's gotta feel some level
It
of
wasn't that.
relief.
It wasn't that, although that was my story. I
Yeah.
believe that. I could have, said, hey, I'm coming back. And everybody said, well, no, we filled your spot. So
Well, you never got there, so it doesn't matter.
those are realities. But here I am at this bar and on Sunset Boulevard across from the Comedy Store in Los Angeles. And everybody who was anybody was coming in there. And it was funny because the first few people I'm working the first week and people are going, do you do voiceovers? And I was like, yeah, what do you have? And I just got right back to business. I didn't know what a voiceover was. And finally, I turned to this fellow, Roy Silver, who was the owner of the restaurant. And I said, Roy, what is a voiceover? He says, well, Rick, he goes, it's probably the best way to make money in the shortest amount of time without having to be on the camera. So a voiceover is truly anytime you hear the voice in any medium, whether it's a film, a television, or what, and you don't see the individual. So cartoons are voiceovers. Commercials are voiceovers. And he said, that's, you know, that's been, so the next time somebody said that to me, I said, yes, I do. Why? And he said, well, because you have this great voice. I'd love to have you come in and test for something. And I said, sure, I'll do that. Who's your agent? Well, that was always the caveat because I didn't have an agent. And you don't get an agent until you get work. And you don't get work until you get an agent. So it's that catch-22 situation. And finally he said, well, come on in and test anyhow. And I landed a Toyota commercial.
First try.
That was it. It was like out of the chute, and I got it. And I'm thinking that can be the curse right there, because now you figure you know what you're doing, which couldn't be a bigger mistake. But I got that, and then I wound up, you know, doing auditioning, and I started taking workshops, and I was feverish about it. I took 4 and 5 workshops a week. You know, all the money I made at the bar, pretty much what I didn't spend on dates and girls, I spent on acting classes. And then I landed a shot on General Hospital. And to me, that was like such a thrill. It was such an epiphany moment for me. And I got this job on General Hospital. It was a reoccurring role. I did it like 4 times in the course of a few months.
How long in between the Toyota commercial and the General Hospital role?
Maybe 6 months.
So did you, it hadn't, I'm going to guess that it hadn't set in like, oh, maybe this was, this isn't going to work. It hadn't been enough time for that to be the case yet. Or did you have those thoughts like a couple months after the Toyota, like, oh, I'm spending all this money on acting classes. What am I doing here? Did you have that or not? Not quite.
No, I didn't have the kind of that give up. It was always about, you know, this is, you knew that this was the path.
Yeah.
You know? You're going to hear rejections. You're going to get rejections. You're going to get, you know, you're going to be canceled out. You're going to, you know, nobody's going to want you. And then all of a sudden somebody's going to see something.
Did you give yourself a timeline? Like, I know some people that go out there, like, I'll give myself 2 years. And if it doesn't work out, I'll come back and I'll do whatever. Or were you so deep into the, like, traveling around, doing art, being a bartender, that you were just like, this is what I'm doing now in life. And this is just another chapter of it?
Well, kind of. I mean, I knew that this was the path. I knew there was, you couldn't really put a timeline on. And those that did usually stopped just before they would have hit.
Yeah.
You know, it's the guy digging the gold mine who gives up and 2 more swings of the pickaxe and he would have struck the, you know, the main vein. So I kind of knew that. I mean, that was the pathology. Everybody understood you're going to suffer. You're going to go on. You're going to wonder what's next. You go into every audition with the idea that this could be the one, you know, and that's the worst thing you can do to yourself.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, people smell it. You know, I think there's that idea that, you know, like a woman knows what you're looking for when you, you know, the way you approach them. And if you just be genuine and be yourself, you'll have a lot more success. And that was the same thing with this. And you learn that after a while, you start to give up. And they always say, just about the time you don't care is when it starts to happen. And I was fortunate that way. So General Hospital was good for me. It led to some other things. I had some friends in town that were photographers. They used me for some modeling jobs at the time. And I wound up catching a little bit part here and a bit part there, a motorcycle safety film for Harley Davidson. You know, woman calls me up. She goes, can you ride a motorcycle? And I remembered a story that somebody had told me about Clint Eastwood when they asked, you know, how tall are you? And his response was, how tall do I need to be? You know, and so you answered every question with a positive. She says, have you ever driven a motorcycle? I said, never. I never had. I didn't say that. I said, yeah, I can do that. So I show up for this Harley Davidson motorcycle safety film, and we wind up wrecking the bike and nearly wrecking my leg. But I got through it, got a paycheck, and that's all that mattered at that point in time. And then I got a show that was called, I think it was called Parker Lewis Can't Lose, which was a Saturday morning show for kids. And through that, I got an audition for Wham-O Toys to do the voiceover. And I became the voice for Wham-O Toys for a year. So any Saturday morning cartoon when the kids were listening and the commercial came on and it was here, it's new from Wham-O. That was me. And so I struggled with it and kept going, classes, working on it, always tending bar to kind of save my ass. And then as time went by, I was more known for what I was doing in the restaurant business than I was for my acting, until it got me to a place where I was running a restaurant, which was like the go-to place for the power heads of the entertainment industry.
Before we jump into that, how were
Yeah.
the audition? How were the auditions for you? Was there nerves, confidence, like some level of you don't even know enough to be nervous for the first couple? Like, how was the audition process for you? Especially not getting an agent and then, or not having one, and then I assume you got one eventually, I would guess.
Yes.
So how did all that work out for you? What was the process like?
Well, you're trying to figure it out because as many people who are doing it, I would always tell people this. I said, for all those people that are doing it, if you become an endodontist or you want to be an endodontist can tell you the pathway to get there. If you want to become an attorney can tell you the pathway to get there. But with all the actors that are out there's nobody who can really give you the route. Nobody can tell you the path. It's different for everybody. What I didn't learn till later on was it's an inside job. It's about creating certainty. It's about having that mindset that's not questioning everything, but that's going in with an answer, with a response. And that you have to make a choice. This became, Eric, this became a very important life lesson for me because it was no longer about the acting. This was about life in itself. And it's part of what I impart to people today through the coaching and life coaching part of it. It's establishing certainty. No matter what it is in life you think you're selling, and this message goes out to anybody who's listening, whatever service or product they think they're delivering, the real service they're selling is certainty. When you deliver certainty, people are buying. And we live in a world today where everything's for sale and everybody's product is the best. And it's one thing after another. We're bombarded day in and day out, especially with the internet now. And so for me, making that distinction that it was about the certainty of it, that came with the seasoning of time. And that became how I got the agent. It became how I took on the opportunities that came. Whereas before that, I was bewildered. I didn't know. You got an opportunity? Well, you're going to go in and give it your best shot. And it was after that that I really learned that, you know what? You've got to go in and do what you think is right. You're either going to be on or you're not. They don't know what they're looking for until they find it. So this idea that they know who they're looking for and they're looking at 200 people for a particular part is an abstract. They won't know until they see it or hear it. And then there's something that clicks. So there's no real science to that other than having that sense of self-esteem without cockiness, that sense of certainty without being bulletproof. And that's what really creates the wins in life, not only in that field, but in every other field. And so I wound up then getting a real break. Someone who I'd met throughout the business was a big producer. So we'd like to have you come in and read for a part. I said,
This is
sure.
before or after the restaurant, you started running the
This
restaurant.
is while I was in the restaurant
Okay,
business.
so you get to you're running the restaurant. You said it, I think the power heads of Santa Barbara are coming in. So is this after that? So what, I guess walk me through the you're now running the restaurant instead of being the bartender.
Right. I was the maitre d' and manager of the restaurant, a very prominent
So how does
restaurant.
that transition work for you, and how does I cut you off, I think, or asked the question, I think it may be a bad time. I think you're gonna go into, because you're saying lots of important people were coming into the restaurant and stuff, and I think that you were going somewhere with that. So let's jump back into the story about there, if where you're going now is after that, and this we can keep going in chronological.
Yeah, the people that I met first in running the bar at this place called Roy's, which was on Sunset. I mean, we had everybody in the entertainment industry was in and out of there. And it was the kind of place you had to have a reservation even to sit at the bar, you know. But the people that I was dealing with on a nightly basis were, you know, John Travolta, Dr. Timothy Leary, Olivia Newton-John, Johnny Carson, Bob Dylan, Jackson Brown, the Smothers Brothers. These people were all in there all the time. The Bee Gees, you know, think of Saturday Night Fever. It was that period of time.
And this is
And
the one that your friend was running that he asked you to come help you with.
yes, yeah,
Okay, okay.
he asked me to come out and do that. And that worked really well for me for like 3.5 years. That was a great experience because of the people I met, the kind of money that I made, the contacts that I had. The opportunities. I mean, we had people, Jimmy Niederlander, who owned, he was the patriarch of the Niederlander family, which was theaters throughout the world. And he would come in. He'd go, Rick, you never ask me for anything. You know, he goes, these people are always asking me for stuff. He goes, you ever want to go to see a show or do anything? Just call my assistant, let them know who you are. And I said, well, okay. And I remember a funny aside was I was dating a girl who was very into ballet, and I ballet leaves me sleepy. I just, you know, I'm not that guy, but I thought to impress her, Jimmy said, call, and I saw in the paper the Bolshoi was coming to town, the great Russian ballet, and so I said, oh, this would be great. So I called up, and she says, okay. Her assistant goes, which one would you like to see? Well, I didn't know any ballets. I mean, the only name that popped up was Swan Lake. I said, Swan Lake. Okay, there I am with two seats, center stage, third row for the Bolshoi doing Swan Lake.
Wow.
And this young lady, about 15 minutes into it, is giving me an elbow, goes, you're snoring. It just wasn't me. But the reason I bring it up is because it was the perks that came along with being in proximity to all these people. And that's another thing that's very important in life. I mean, certainty is paramount, but proximity is a great vehicle. So the people that you're around, the circles that you surround yourself with, there's an expression that says you are the mean of the 5 to 10 people you spend the most time with.
Yeah.
And because I was spending all my time with these people, it was a great opportunity. I got to do a lot of things I probably would have never otherwise done. That said, one day they said, Rick, come here for a minute. I came over to the table and they said, I want to have you come in and read for a part. I said, okay. I said, I'd be honored to do that. And I went in and I wound up landing a spot on a movie called Die Hard. And Die Hard at the time, no one knew what it was going to become. It was Bruce Willis. It was his departure from a TV show called Moonlighting. And here it was, you know, it was an action-packed film. I mean, everybody pretty much knows what Die Hard was today. Well, I was the security guard at the front desk when Bruce Willis lands in Los Angeles to go to his estranged wife's Christmas party. He walks in. And there's a computer bank in front of him, and he goes like, "I'm looking for Holly Gennaro," and he goes, "Well, just I say we'll type in the name on that computer." It was a touch screen. Nobody had seen a touch screen at that point in time, so this was a precursor to what was to come. Types in the name. I direct him off to the party. Next thing you know, I'm watching these monitors, the security desk, and I hear the music change. Now you know the plot of the story is about to pick up, and these trucks come in. And next thing I know, I look up in the front door is Alexander Gudinov, the Russian ballerina, and a guy named Clarence Gilliard, who was the partner in Texas Ranger, you know, with I'm forgetting his name right now. But they're the two actors that are coming in playing these terrorists. I don't know they're terrorists. And they come walking in, they're talking about the Lakers. And Worthing turns off and he passes off to Kareem. Kareem turns and shoots. And with that, they put a 9mm in my head. I get knocked over backwards. And that's where the action begins for the film. So it's still a thing I get emails about all the time, particularly at Christmas time, because there's the ongoing argument, is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Yeah.
Not. But that was what opened the door. That was the big break for me. And I wound up doing a dozen feature films, some episodics, some sitcoms. I did NYPD Blue for a while. I did Murphy Brown for a while. And it was great. And after a while, I just got to the point where I said, you know, it's not floating my boat anymore. I'm not getting the big break. And this might be what you were referring to too when somebody says there's a timeline to it. I kept thinking, you know, I'm not getting the big break. I've been at it for 11 years. I've had a nice modicum of success. A lot of people would be happy with what I did. I wanted more. And I wasn't achieving more. I wasn't getting my own show. I wasn't getting the starring role. Everything I did was a co-starring role. I'm honored and grateful for that. But I never had that break to take me to that next place. I wound up doing another 48 hours, LA Story with Steve Martin and John Lithgow, House of Secrets and Lies with Connie Selica. I did P.S. I Love You, which was a detective story based in Palm Springs. And I did a number of these different things. It was great. It was good fun. I enjoyed it. The money was good. I got nice recognition. But there was something more for me.
I want to ask you about that specifically, because I think a lot
Please.
of people, like you said, would have been, if you took a young actor and sort of started from square one, you're like, this will be your resume. Like, I think a lot of them would be like, yes, please. Like, I'll take it. I find that that happens a lot, right? When you are in it in the day to day, and you just finished with Die Hard, now you're doing LA, or NYPD Blue. And some of the other things, and you're like, oh, okay, I did that, I did that, I did that. Like, when's the did it sounds like you've reflected now on that time period, but in that time, was there any resentment towards you hadn't got the big break yet? Or like, where's the like, where did the decision point come from? I haven't got the big break yet. It's time to shift life paths again. Or I'm one shovel scoop away from the gold mine. Where was that for you?
It wasn't there at that time. That was not part of my awareness at the time. I kept thinking, you know, it's one more audition. You know, it's one more audition. I'm going to get it. One more spot. And then it's a cruel business. I will say that to anybody who's listening that thinks they want to aspire to that, just toughen up, get a thick skin, because it's a tough, tough business. And here I had this resume with, you know, these 12 movies on it and things. And I had a friend who called me up who was a assistant producer. And he says, Ricky, because I have a part I want you to read for. And I said, okay, great. And, well, let me rewind just a moment. I think some of my greatest momentum building moments were not necessarily the parts that I got, but the ones that I became that close to. So there were a couple of roles where it came down to me and somebody else in the auditioning process. And in the auditioning process, for those who don't know, you'll go in for an initial reading, then you'll get called back if they like that. And then if they like that, they narrow the circle a little bit more, and then they call you back again to the point of where you're usually competing against one other person that they think is pretty good for this, and they think you're pretty good for this. And when it comes down to that, you feel great. There was a movie called Urban Cowboy, and that was John Travolta and Deborah Winger. And there was a part that I got down to like the fourth round of auditions for, and it came up against me and this other fella. And he wound up getting it. And I was just thrilled that I got that far. That was almost better than having gotten the role. I think Scott Glenn was the character who got that role. And he played the prison rodeo cowboy in that movie, if you remember the storyline at all. And Scott played it much better. I think he would have been, I think he was better for the part than I was. But to have gotten that close meant a lot, you know? There was another one where they did a remake of The Getaway, which was a movie that was originally done by Steve McQueen and Ally McGraw. Now they were doing the remake of it, and a producer called me in for that. And it got down to me and a guy named Michael Murphy, and he was the one that got the part. Michael, was it Michael Moriarty? I think it was. Trying to remember his last name, and I can see his face. But those two roles meant more to me than the ones that I got, because the competition was strict, you know, and it got down. And I think, you know, we lose sight of what the word competition truly means. The word competition comes from the Latin competere, and it means to strive together to achieve greatness. So it's like, if you and I are competing for something, I'm going to bring the best out in you, and you're going to bring the best out in me, and we'll both wind up better than we would have been if we did it on our own. And so that kind of, that sense about competition, it's not about I win, you lose, or you win and I lose, but bringing that out. And I felt that, and that was the richest part of it. So that said, I get called up by this friend of mine who's an assistant producer to go out. I have to travel across Los Angeles, which in traffic in Los Angeles is unlike most anywhere else. And I get there like an hour, you know, after driving there, and he gives me the sides, and it's one sentence. And I was like, Tony, you brought me out here knowing what I've done with all these different roles to read this one sentence because you didn't think I could deliver it. And I was furious. I was nuts. And it was like the breaking point for me. It was like, this isn't Tony. This is the business. The business is like this. They have no qualms about putting you through all of this. You and I both could have just said, okay, let's deliver this line now, and either one of us could get hired. And that was kind of a real turning point for me. It broke my spirit. And that's a tough place to be in any profession, when your spirit gets broken. And I didn't recover it. And then I did another part for somebody else in a TV movie. And I saw it online. I watched it on TV. And I just didn't like it. I didn't like how I was showing up. So that enters the next phase. That's where I met a fellow named Anthony, or Tony Robbins. And I met this guy really through one of his infomercials at the time, if you remember infomercials. And he and Lisa Gibbons are talking. It's probably 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm home from the restaurant, having closed up the restaurant. I'm going through the mail and I'm listening to this infomercial. And I think, that's the next place for me, to learn the psychology and human behavior that's making me run, and to learn how to manage it. So often we hear somebody say, you know, well, that's just who I am. Well, it's not. You know, Eric, nobody is just who they are. You are the product of the decisions and the stories you make. You're the product of the patterns you run. You know, we come into this life with only two fears: a fear of loud noises and a fear of falling. Those are natural fears. Everything else is learned. Everything else comes from a story. Now, that's objectionable to some people. They go, no, it's not. I mean, this is my life, and this is hard, and this is what I did, or this is what happened. No. That's the story. You can change the story. And that's what Tony started to teach me. So I listened to this infomercial. I said, that's it. I'm going. And I didn't call any of my friends to say, hey, do you want to go? Or I committed to this weekend called Unleash the Power Within Weekend.
So you'd been acting for, where are you, like 40s at this point? Early 40s, something like that?
Age-wise?
Yeah.
Oh, no. I was probably still, well, let's see. I have to do the math. That was probably, maybe late 30s.
Okay.
So, yeah. I went to this weekend at the hotel, and I walked in, and there's this music blasting, rock and roll blasting, people jumping up and down on chairs. And I'm thinking, I'm in the wrong place. This looks like the land of the misfit toys. I mean, this is what's going on here. I came to go to a seminar. And in my mind, the seminar was, I had khakis on, I had a button-down Oxford shirt, a blazer, and I had a portfolio to take notes in. And I couldn't have been more off base. You know, I called it wrong, you know. And In the first half hour to an hour, Tony said a couple things that really sunk in for me. And I felt that he was talking to me. And, we've all had those moments, whether it's with a teacher, a priest, a minister, a parent, a coach, where what they're saying is a message to a lot of people, but you feel like this is really directed at me. And the two things he said were, one is, you're going to hear a lot of things this weekend. Some of them you'll agree with, some of them you'll disagree with, some of them you'll love, and some of them you will hate. All I ask is that you try it all on for the weekend. And on Monday, if it's not right for you, just take it off like a sweater or a jacket that didn't fit. But if there's one pearl, one little piece of information in this weekend that you benefit from, and you build on that going forward in life, it's going to expand. It's going to have great value. So please consider that. And the second thing is, by all means, play full out. Now, that doesn't sound like a very, epiphany kind of statement, but to me, it meant the world because I thought about it. As I said, I always had a strong circle of friends going through high school. I had a great support group as a family. So I always had people around me that helped buoyed me up. And I did what I needed to do to kind of stay in the mix. If as a coach playing either lacrosse or football, somebody said, okay, we're going to take a lap, I didn't take that. I didn't see that as an opportunity to get better. I saw it as a punishment. Take a lap.
Most of
And
us
I felt like
do.
if I'm somewhere in the middle, I'm fine. If I get through this, fine. We can just, and if there is a regret that I have in life, it's that I didn't see that early on, that this was an opportunity to improve. And if it's a lesson that I try to give to other people, if someone had taken a knee with me, and I don't mean that in the Star Spangled Banner sense, but I mean that in the sense, if someone had taken a knee and said, listen, Rick, he goes, what is it you want? And what is the feeling that you have that's holding you back? This is how we can achieve it. Well, that would have been the epiphany I needed much earlier on, but it wasn't presented to me that way. I had to keep discovering it on my own and through one error after another. Life is not about trial and error. It's about trial and self-correction. And that's one of the most important things I can tell anybody who's listening. It's really about trial and self-correction. And at that point in time, I knew when I played ball, I didn't play full out. When I studied, I didn't study full out. There wasn't anything that I did full out. So when he said play full out, I said, okay, next thing I know, I'm on the chair clapping like everybody else. And I'm like, I'm ready to go all in. And that was a huge distinction for me. It was really probably one of the biggest shifts that I had had since I had read Wayne Dyer's books back as a teenager. It was that great distinction of like, I am in charge of my psychology. I am in charge of my human behavior. This is the product of my choices, good, bad, or indifferent. I got to own that. And that was the richness in it. And for me, it helped me embark on it. So I went back for more. This was a 4-day weekend. I still have those notes from 1993 that I took copious notes. I wrote down every word. Tony says, and I got and, and so I went back to the next seminar. And then I signed up, and God knows how I was inspired to do this. I had just gotten, I remember I had just gotten a gold American Express card. And it's not the platinum card, but it was the gold card. It's a charge card. It's not a credit card even. You charge something and you pay for it. And I thought, well, there's no limit on here. They offered a program called Mastery University, where they were going to teach you about the fine points of finance, health, emotions, relationship, leadership. And I said, I got to do this. I got so much out of this weekend. I got to do this. And I went to the back long before it was time to go back there to sign up. And everybody's like, okay, well, hold on. As soon as Tony's finished talking about it, we're going to sign people up. I go, no, I need to sign up now. I was so emphatic, and I didn't realize I was talking to his then wife. And I said, "No, I have to sign up right now." She says, "Okay, we'll get you signed up." She says, she hired this guy, Chris Hendrickson, who is still a friend of mine to this day. And Chris, just sign Rick up when we're ready. And so I signed up and I put down $12,000 on an 18-month program, which I wound up completing. I had no idea how I was going to pay for this, but American Express was willing to play with me. So I thought, well, let's do it. And I just knew that somewhere in the course of that program, I was going to find the answers I needed. I was going to find a way to pay this off through what I was about to learn. Talk about paying it forward. I mean, I was committing it forward. And sure enough, I read everything I could about psychology and human behavior at that point in time. I was dutiful in volunteering for programs. And in doing so, this became it was my life. It was the core of what I was doing. The psychology and human behavior, understanding human patterns, understanding how to interrupt a pattern, understanding how to enhance a pattern, understanding to find out where did they come from? Where's your story that brought you to this point? What is it that you're carrying forward that maybe it's time to let it go? Those things became very clear to me. And you learn best by teaching others. I think, when you've got a lesson, you score it. Tony used to have an expression. People say, "How come you're so smart? How do you know all this stuff?" I said, "I attend all my own seminars." So there's a great deal to that. And that's what brought me to the place where I then was committed to helping others. I mean, I've always kind of been, I think, helpful to others. I've always tried to reach out to other people, but now I knew this was my mission. This was my passion. All the other things I had done in life led me to this point. And there was a book that I read, a dear friend of mine from high school, actually, we're still very close friends. He was working for Forbes magazine and he had to do a book report or review for one of their sales meetings. And it was a book by Mark McCormick called What They Never Taught Me at Harvard Business School. And in this book, there was a chapter about the fellow who was the CEO of General Motors, who was to become the CEO at Rolex Watches. And all his colleagues would say, "What do you know about timepieces?" He says, "I know this. Timepieces aren't my business. They're not my business at Rolex. People are my business. They were my business at General Motors, and they will be my business at Rolex Watches." And I realized then that all this time I spent in the restaurant business, in the restaurant world, the hospitality world, that's not me. That's the vehicle I have used who I am through. People are my business. They were my business, in the restaurant business. They were my restaurant business in the bar business. They were my business even in school, my university time. All that wasn't about the classes, it was about the people connections. So that fed me, and I learned the tools, techniques, strategies, and skills through the circle of people with Tony Robbins to be able to enhance that and hone the skills to be able to help others, which also helped me, certainly. I don't miss that by any means. But by doing that, I was able to pass the baton. And I think in life, we live in the concept of a bucket brigade. We are handed something. We get to have that for a moment and, utilize it, but then it's time to pass it on. And that was the most important thing that I could do at that point in time. And so I have been blessed in my life to get tapped on the shoulder and introduced to new opportunities. Doing this with Tony, and I did it for 8 years, traveled around the world with him. And I got a phone call one day from somebody who said, "Would you consider talking to my bosses? I'm just here in a sales meeting, and the executive team is looking for somebody like you." And I said to my friend Bobby, I said, "Bobby, I do my own investing, but I really don't know the financial world that well." He goes, "No, you don't need to. They are looking for somebody who has the skill sets that you have, only they don't know it. Because they've been hiring people all along who came out of school studying finance and started their first job, their whole work career has been in the world of finance, but they don't have the skills that you have. And I told them about you and that you're a great public speaker and that you have a great discipline and that you can lead people and you can influence people and you can help people understand new concepts and new ideas through metaphors. And they're anxious to meet you. I said, well, I'll talk to them. You know, I'll talk to anybody. Don't take exception to that, Eric. But I'll talk to anybody. So next thing you know, one of the executive team from American Express calls me up on the phone to have a 20-minute conversation. 90 minutes later, we get off the phone and he says, do you mind if I call you back tomorrow? I said, not at all. And I felt it went pretty well. I have a tendency sometimes to talk too long. Maybe you've noticed that. But Harvey called me back the next day, said, we'd want to fly you up to Minneapolis to meet with the executive team. And because I've told them about you and we feel very strongly about this meeting. So I took it and I got into Minneapolis the night before and checked into the hotel. In the bar were a number of people who were candidates for this very same role that they were looking at me at or for. And so the next day I'm in my suit, all ready for my interviews in the financial community. To me, it's another part to play, right? Another acting role. And I had my stack of resumes and I was to sit in the boardroom. And one after another, seven executives were going to come in and meet with me and talk to me, interview me. And the last one was the national sales manager. And he goes, Rick, he goes, I'm looking at your resume here. He goes, and I see that, you know, you were on the Olympic Committee in Los Angeles. You've run some of the most powerful restaurants in the country. You were in the entertainment business. You worked with Tony Robbins. You did General Hospital. He goes, I just don't know why you would want this job. And I turned to him and I said, with all respect, if I may speak freely. He says, yes, of course. I said, why the hell would you want me for this job? I said, I have no background in finance. I said, all these guys I met last night, you know, they studied at this school and that school for finance and have been at their whole work history. And he looked at me very clearly and he said, Rick, I can teach you what they know about finance. I cannot teach them what you know about people. And I said, golly, I said, I'm flattered and I'm honored. And because you're the kind of guy that likes to think outside the box, that's the kind of people I like to work with. If we come up with a number, I'll be happy to be on your team. And I did, I joined the team and I was brought out there. I'd never had an expense account in my life. All of a sudden, now I've got a great salary, an expense account, travel money, and I'm calling on five states in the southwestern United States, like California, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, and Hawaii. I'm going, wow, this is pretty cool. And I wound up doing that for a few years and was very successful at it. And then they shut down that division of the company, and I wound up getting picked up about 6 months later by a company called Allianz, which is the second largest financial management company in the world next to BlackRock. And I had a great run with them and hit my five-year goal in 14 months. And I think the thing that made me different, the thing that lended to that success, was that understanding of who I was, going in with a feeling of certainty about who I was, understanding and recognizing patterns and being able to interrupt them and introduce a new and more empowering pattern for these, because I called on brokers, financial planners, bankers, and it was about introducing the American Express or Allianz financial products into their clients' portfolios. So I had to get them to stop doing what they were currently doing and start doing what we wanted them to do. And it worked out great until 2012. And in that point in time, the industry had a really rough time because the financial institutions were having a tough time. The treasury bills were down. There was very little money to back these things. And so I was let go only because they cut the division altogether. They couldn't afford to run it anymore. And we had hit the goal they wanted. And I would get called up by Prudential, Transamerica, Hartford, a number of all the big financial companies get flown in and they'd say, we can't afford you. I said, well, I'll work for free. Just, you know, let me work for commissions. In that industry, there's an expression that says you eat what you kill.
Yeah.
So you have a base salary, but your commission, I said, I'll do that. They said they couldn't operate that way, that they needed to be able to pay me and they couldn't. So that's when I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, why don't I teach people what I've done?
So I think, let me, so I have a game tonight, so I have to run in a few minutes.
Okay.
But I know, so you got the life coaching started right after this, correct?
I went back to the life coaching that I had been doing with Tony Robbins during those 8 years where I was coaching people. And what I was doing with the financial brokers was coaching them. So I went back to public speaking, which is what I was doing with sales meetings in the financial community. I'd go and speak at these institutions, speak at these companies. And there's a funny little aside to that. This will only take a moment. Going back to the third grade, I had the role in a musical to play the sandbox. And this was my first performance ever. I asked if I could go to the boys' room, and I never came out. I was terrified. The same kid who was terrified to just play the sandbox in third grade wound up with 12 movies in a co-starring role and speaking to large audiences. The largest audience I ever spoke to was in the Miami Auditorium for 21,000 people with Tony Robbins. And I wound up teaching people. I coach people today on how to break patterns, how to recognize their story, how to recognize where the value is in their story, how to take that to the next level, how to use the disciplines, how to have the psychology of certainty and self-esteem, to know that they are worthy, to know that they are, in fact, ready for what's next to them, or it wouldn't be in front of them. And I learned the skills of hypnotherapy by chance, really, the first time, and then I made a year-long intensive study into the subconscious mind, because that's where all our behavior is rooted. You know, many people think they make conscious decisions, but those are all checked and balanced by the 80% of your thinking process, which is within the subconscious. And that's where your feelings and your beliefs and your core concepts really live. So until we dive in and make the changes there, we don't change. We may change momentarily. Your conscious mind's there to help you decide whether to look left or right when you cross the street. But those fundamental things that you do every day, the dragons you fight and the victories you win, are all coming from the subconscious and your thoughts and patterns there. And so I work with people today to help build the best them that they can be.
Well, look at that. You wrapped it up quite nicely. Now we'll have to have a whole another episode to talk about the subconscious.
Rick, happy to do it.
I very much enjoyed it and appreciated your time greatly. Normally I'd ask people if they have any last nickels, but I think you said them all. No, I'm just kidding. If the people are interested in finding out more, where should they go to find you or your website?
Well, first off, let me say that this has been an honor for me. Thank you very much, Eric. I appreciate your interest and helping me broaden the audience, perhaps, and maybe some of the things I've said have helped some of the people out there. And certainly, if anybody wants to know more, they can go to my website, which is formerly everybody would say www, but it's simply optimumlife.us. optimumlife.us, and that will give you my website, and through there they can contact me. I'm happy to do a free consultation for 20 to 30 minutes with an individual to find out if we're a fit and help them go forward and do what they want to do and help them be who they want to be.
Excellent.
You know? And well, I appreciate the opportunity and happy to come back anytime you might need me.
Yes, we'll definitely have to do that. I could talk to you for another 3 hours, of course. For those listening, links will be in the description. And we will see you guys next time. Peace.
Peace out. Thank you.